Welcome to International Edition. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. presidential battle gets a boost from the first Republican debate. We'll talk about it with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Does an attack on a mosque in Saudi Arabia mean a possible attempt to attack the Saudi government? We'll explore that with Jeffrey Young. An international effort to plant trees is underway.
We've planted over 100 million trees, and we've seen a tree planting strategy called the forest garden approach that has a really powerful triple bottom line.
And if you want to live longer, eat more spicy food. We'll talk with the author of a new study. It's all here on International Edition from the Voice of America. Well, the top 10 Republican U.S. presidential candidates officially launched the 2016 campaign season. It was their first debate held in Cleveland, Ohio, and despite the hype and the buildup, in many ways, the debate did rise to expectations. Billionaire Donald Trump gave notice he's not going to collapse anytime soon and that he'll eagerly respond to attacks. But Trump may have sparked some doubts among some Republicans about his commitment to the party. He was the only candidate on stage who refused to commit to supporting the eventual Republican nominee, nor would he rule out a possible third-party bid for president. That drew some boos from the audience. With us in studio is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Did that set him apart right away, Jim? That was it, right?
Started off with a bang. That was it. And, you know, we're getting some interpretation now from analysts who are looking at this. And they're wondering if this is a turning point in the whole Trump surge and the whole sort of GOP race. It's too early to say. But, you know, Trump was typical Trump. Let's not forget. He was bombastic. He was aggressive in tone, willing to strike back at anybody who hit at him. But in some interesting interviews afterwards, some of the voters in a focus group done by Fox News Channel were put off by Trump. They thought he was too aggressive in his tone, and they also thought he was evasive in some of his answers about what specifically he would do about policy approaches. So sort of a mixed night for Trump. Trump says he's going to get a boost in the polls. We'll see soon enough.
Well, his style does rile a lot. It pleases a lot of others. He is the number one. He's still number one in the polls as far as we've
seen. He is, you know, but how far does this go? I mean, can you win the White House kind of being a crank and being someone who is complaining about everything, getting people whipped up? We've seen this before where it has a certain impact, but it often has a ceiling. And the question is, when does this happen? And that's why you see people like Jeb Bush, John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, these more sort of sober people who place a kind of emphasis on a more polite tone, kind of waiting in the wings. But the interesting thing is, people like Kasich actually were praising Donald Trump, saying he struck a nerve. And the only one who really went after him among his rivals was Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, somewhat aggressively. So it looks like Trump's rivals right now are still somewhat unsure how to deal with him. They'd love to get some of that spotlight, but he's not giving it up right now.
I think the main question that all of us are dealing with, and a lot of the voters, is that have things changed so much in the United States that Trump does have a chance to become president of the United States?
And that's an open question right now, because I think that one of the big takeaways from the debate was he did not self-implode. He gets to fight another day. He may take some hits from this debate, but his supporters will be cheered by his performance. You know, at times it looks like the Donald wants to become the Ronald, as in Ronald Reagan, but that's not really him. And, you know, does Donald Trump kind of curtail some of the aggressive attacks down the line, or does he ride those right to the end? Too early to say, but these debates are giving us an important window into the Republican field. Right now, he continues to dominate, and I think his rivals are going to try to come up with different ways to steal some of that spotlight.
Well, it becomes entertaining after a while if you look at it from an entertainment point of view. But what about foreign policy? Anything stand out as far as that's concerned?
Oh, yeah. The Obama record on foreign policy will be a huge issue in the campaign, and Republicans will do all they can to tie Hillary Clinton to that record. You're going to hear a lot about the Iran nuclear deal, about the administration's efforts to counter the Islamic State, just to name a few issues. So that is going to continue right up until Election Day, I think. And it's another chance for these Republicans to put Hillary Clinton in the crosshairs.
Any other candidates stand out?
Marco Rubio had a good night. And, you know, in the earlier debate, which was like the little kids table at Thanksgiving, the seven who did not make the top 10 cut, Carly Fiorina, the former CEO of Hewlett Packard, did quite well. And who knows, maybe did well enough to boost herself up into the sort of top tier. And, you know, she's the only Republican woman in the race so far. So it might do the party well to have her appear at the main debates now.
As always, thanks, Jim. Greatly appreciate it. Jim Malone is VOA's national correspondent. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study shows that the world's glaciers are melting faster than ever. An international team of researchers led by the World Glacier Monitoring Service at the University of Zurich have completed a comprehensive analysis of data on global glacial changes for the last 120 years. The study compared observations made from 2001 to 2010 to data gathered in the past by on-site, airborne, and satellite methods. The researchers find that glaciers today are losing between 1/2 to 1 meter of ice thickness each year. That is between 2 and 3 times more than the amount of glacial ice lost on average over the 20th century. The researchers say that for the time span observed, the rate of global glacier melt is unprecedented. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Now, you've heard about last night's Republican debate in Cleveland. What do a lot of people on social media think about it? As always, our reporter Andrew Palcheski is here with a look at what's being said today in social media. What do you have to share? Was the debate big?
Oh, absolutely. Hashtag GOP debate was trending all through the day yesterday and into the night. And it was interesting because you were seeing people highlight their favorite sound bites and moments from the debate. And Donald Trump, pretty much as he did in the debate, dominated the social media. And he's dominating it again today. Megyn Kelly, who is one of the Fox News anchors who asked some of the questions during the debate, called him out for some sexist comments that he made. Well, he's taking to his Twitter now and lashing out at her, saying she wasn't fair, she was mean. And his supporters are latching onto this. They're agreeing. He's retweeting a lot of his supporters that have some not nice things to say about Megyn Kelly. So that's kind of driven the social media as far as the debate's gone.
Anybody sticking up for Megyn Kelly?
There are people that are sticking up for her and saying, no, it was fair. But it's kind of created this new battle and war of words on social media. Interestingly, in the midst of all this fracas in Cleveland, Hillary Clinton was at a fundraiser, and the selfie with her and Kim Kardashian and Kanye West is appearing on social media. So she was off having a...
That'll bring me out to the polls.
Yeah, having a good time there. Hashtag John Voyage, John Stewart. Of course, leaving The Daily Show. So that's a trending topic all through the night yesterday. It was actually interesting because people were tweeting about the show and talking about the show before it even aired. The show tapes earlier in the evening, airs at 11 p.m. Eastern time. So the show wrapped up around 7 o'clock in the evening. So people were tweeting about the guests. They were kind of giving a preview of what was to come. And then, of course, throughout the show, people posting their clips, posting tributes to Stewart, saying he's going to be missed. But I think he said on the show, he said, no one's dying. It's okay. We'll still be around. But a lot of admiration for him after a great career as a comedian, satirist, and someone who's really changed American culture.
By all means. I haven't watched it yet, so I appreciate you not saying anything about it.
I will leave it for the viewers to check out all the contributions from all of the different people, but it was a great episode.
As always, thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew Palcheski with us all the time here on International Edition as far as what is happening as far as social media is concerned. Let's move our attention to the Middle East now. A new Islamic State affiliate is claiming responsibility for killing 15 people in a suicide bombing at a Saudi mosque used by security forces. This group is calling itself the Hejaz province of the Islamic State. It said it carried out the attack and made the claim in a Twitter statement hours after a suicide bomber detonated the explosives as worshippers prayed at the mosque in the southern city of Aba. The city is close to Saudi Arabia's southern border with war-torn Yemen, and Saudi Arabia has a large part as far as what's happening in Yemen is concerned. Well, in the wake of that bombing, Jeff Young talked with a terrorism financing expert, and Jeff joins us now in studio. There's some pretty interesting angles of this story.
Well, let me start by giving you an old Iraqi curse, Ira. May the skies above you be filled with ravens. In the case of Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, the ravens have come home to roost. As I discussed with Colin Clark, the terrorism expert at the RAND Corporation, it's been Saudi and Gulf money the last couple of years that has been funding a lot of the anti-Bashar al-Assad activity in Syria. But in the process of sending money to try to topple Assad, what's happened is it has equipped and enriched various jihadi groups who have now come back to Saudi Arabia and to the Gulf states. And we've seen a series of bombings. There was one in Kuwait about a month ago that killed close to 30 people. So the ravens have come home to roost. All the money that was sent from there to finance terrorism elsewhere coming back. And Colin Clark at RAND can discuss it more.
Yeah, well, it's a tough task and certainly a tall order, although it's been an objective of jihadist groups for quite some time, going all the way back to Al-Qaeda. When Osama bin Laden offered to protect the Saudi monarchy against Saddam Hussein, he was essentially laughed out of town. And then we all know what happened next. The U.S. was invited in, which was one of the primary reasons bin Laden set his sights on the West.
Now, we have seen before various incidents. Oftentimes, they've been in the eastern province because that's where a lot of Saudi Shia happen to live. But this is different. This is in the southwestern part of the country, and it's also close to Yemen. Any significance whatsoever by that proximity?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a large portion of AQAP, Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula members, are known to be Saudis. And there are thousands of Saudis known to be fighting with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So this could have been merely a target of opportunity. And as I just mentioned, Saudi Arabia has long been a prize for jihadists, mostly because it's home to Mecca and Medina and some of the holiest shrines in Islam.
If there really was a concerted campaign to try to conquer Saudi Arabia, one could only imagine that not only would the Gulf Cooperation Council states be involved in the fight against that, but also I would imagine that the West would also get significantly involved. They're not looking to see Saudi Arabia fall.
Absolutely not. No, I think Saudi Arabia is a totally different situation than someplace like Yemen. Clearly, the West has much more long-term interests in seeing the Saudi monarchy be stable. But again, we've seen this over the past decade, really since the war on terror was launched. The Saudis round up scores of individuals, detain them, arrest them, and things are quiet for a while, only to flare back up. And part of this is they're not really addressing the root causes of much of this.
At the same time that they're doing this, we have wealthy Saudis still shoveling tons of money into so-called Islamic charities and other conduits that ultimately wind up in the hands of jihadists who are not only in Syria, but they're also waging a campaign clearly in Saudi Arabia as well. So it looks like this money is making a full circle, isn't it?
It certainly is, and I document that at length in my book, Terrorism, Inc., where I look at some of the money flowing out of the country. And that's long thought to have been the strategy, which is we're not as concerned about these jihadists as long as they're doing things elsewhere outside of the kingdom. But inevitably, this problem comes home to roost, and I think we're seeing that partially as a result of what's happened recently.
That was Colin Clark, a terrorism specialist with the RAND Corporation at his Pittsburgh office.
Now, he touched on this, Jeff, and that is if they're using money that was given to them by Saudi people, from Saudi philanthropists, from whoever's giving them the money, is this all going to stop? Do they have enough money to keep on going if the Saudi contributors stop contributing?
There are some people in the Arabian Peninsula who are so focused on Wahhabism, on the spread of the purity of a very, very conservative, very limited form of Islam, that these people will continue to shovel money into the Islamic charities toward the jihadis because they do want to see this. There are people in Saudi Arabia who believe that the House of Saud, the King Salman, and the rest of the family are impure. And therefore, in order to sanctify the two holy shrines of Medina and Mecca, they must remove the family in order to make this a holy state.
Would there ever be a possibility that the government, the family of Saudi Arabia, might crack down and somehow crack down on the contribution of money to ISIS and other groups?
Well, so far, this has not overtly happened. Although Saudi security elements have been very busy rounding up anybody that they can find who even has a remote connection to any of this. But you're right. So far, They have not directly said, you're not giving a penny or whatever, a Saudi rial, to any charity that's going to funnel the money. No, they haven't put a stop to this yet.
Jeff Young is covering the Mideast and just about everything else with us here on International Edition from VOA. Coming up on International Edition, trees. An international organization has planted millions of them around the world. How and why? That is on the way on International Edition.
We've planted over 100 million trees, and we've seen a tree planting strategy called the forest garden approach that has a really powerful triple bottom line. Economically, it can significantly increase the income of poor people. We're seeing about 400%, sometimes significantly more. We're talking about people earning less than $1, $2 a day. It can also empower people to become self-sufficient, produce a lot of the forest resources that they need, and to feed themselves with nutritious things, nutritious foods throughout the year. So in the forest garden, there's this garden vegetable element that's very, very important. And then we see tremendous environmental benefits coming out of the program as well. As we are able to really rapidly revitalize the world's degraded lands.
And what are the main areas of focus, or I should say regions of focus for you guys?
Well, for us, as we looked at the problems of poverty and land degradation, we know that we can be the most successful throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And there are three main regions in East Africa, West Africa, and there in Cameroon in the middle that we really want to focus on.
And how, what kind of trees are you planting? You mentioned gardens, so mm-hmm. I'm thinking fruit trees,
sure.
Among others.
Yeah. So the average farmer in our program has a field, a small farm, 1 to 2 acres, that has been extremely depleted, degraded. The trees are gone. Modern agriculture, the need for fuel wood, monocropping, there's not a whole lot left. So oftentimes we're starting from scratch. And we guide farmers through the process of planting fast-growing and thorny trees that help revitalize and stabilize fields. So there's some beautiful impacts in terms of reducing soil erosion and planting trees that fix nitrogen into the soil. So we start to see some environmental and some kind of basic subsistence needs being met real quickly by planting fast-growing trees. And then the next wave, once we get beyond stabilizing the field, revitalizing the soils a bit, then we get to really diversify. And we're looking at the fruit trees, mangoes, avocados, oranges, citrus, guava, you name it, as well as a lot of hardwoods too. So people are getting all kinds of incredible economic, food, and environmental benefits coming out of the tree planting.
How long before a community might reap the benefits of the tree planting?
All of the programs, because we're dealing with impoverished people who are usually food insecure and very hungry, all of the tree planting projects have to immediately begin generating some type of benefits for people. And so that's our programs are designed to finding the fastest growing trees that start producing useful things within the first year, the first 2 years.
And how many countries are you actually in? I know you're focusing on three regions, but...
Sure, it's 6 countries. We'd love to be working in Mali as well, so hopefully Mali will become a 7th. In Senegal and West Africa, Cameroon, and in East Africa, we've got a nice little cluster of Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda. So.
And your goal for this year of planting trees?
Our goal, so it's going to be millions of trees. Last year, we exceeded 20 million trees. Our goal is as much on the trees as it is on the 4,000 families. We're really trying to help 4,000 families plant their way out of poverty. Each family planting thousands of trees each in their new forest garden. We're with 4,000 families right now. We want to grow and scale our programs in those three regions so that we can be reaching 10,000 families within the next few years.
That is our Rebecca Ward, and she was talking with John Leary, and he heads up an organization that's Washington, D.C. based, but as you heard, does work all around the world, especially now in sub-Saharan Africa, and the name of the organization is Trees for the Future, and they say trees bring peace, they bring prosperity, and they're going to continue doing what they've been doing. This is International Edition.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents. a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
You like spicy food? If you do, some new research says you could live longer than those who don't. Joining us on International Edition is Dr. Liu Shi, Associate Professor at Harvard University School of Public Health. Tell us about how this was carried out, where and who took part in this.
The survey is very huge, including the Chinese population from different regions, including nearly 500,000 people.
There are other places in the world where spicy food is popular. In fact, many places around the world where spicy food is popular. Mexico, Latin America. Now, does this translate? Is there a difference in the kind of food that people will eat spicy food in China and the rest of Asia and people eating spicy food in Latin America?
I would not expect any difference. We do need data, but I assume the protective effect of spicy foods should be same because the active components, same in chili peppers, they are not different.
Now, is it just chili peppers that is the reason for longevity, or are there other spicy ingredients involved as well?
Yeah, basically, our data focus on chili pepper. This is the most common part of spicy food in China.
So therefore, other ingredients really did not show up as giving longevity. Is that correct?
Well, we didn't analyze any other specific part of so-called spicy food. As I mentioned earlier, the study we carried out is focused on
If I am someone living in other parts of the world, if I'm living in Africa, if I'm living in the Middle East, what should and could I eat, and will that make me live longer?
We need more evidence. Our study is still the first study. And
that is Dr. Liu Shi of Harvard University and talking about living longer by eating spicy food. Well, we thank you so much for being with us on International Edition. Follow us on Twitter. Find us at VOA_IE. If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, our website, voanews.com. Go to Programs tab and then scroll down to International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. Thanks for being with us. What happened?
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In September, the U.S. Congress will vote on whether or not to disapprove the comprehensive nuclear accord agreed to last month by the P5 plus one countries and Iran. In a speech in Washington defending the deal, President Barack Obama was blunt.
The choice we face is ultimately between diplomacy or some form of war. Maybe not tomorrow. Maybe not 3 months from now, but soon.
Mr. Obama added that, ironically, military action would be far less effective than this deal in preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Every estimate, including those from Israeli analysts, suggest military action would only set back Iran's program by a few years at best, which is a fraction of the limitations imposed by this deal.
Mr. Obama called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, the strongest nonproliferation agreement ever negotiated, permanently prohibiting Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon by verifiably cutting off all Iran's pathways to a bomb, thereby securing one of the U.S.'s critical security objectives by means of hard, painstaking diplomacy. President Obama noted that all problems with Iran are not solved by the nuclear accord.
The ruling regime is dangerous and it is repressive. We will continue to have sanctions in place on Iran's support for terrorism and violation of human rights. We will continue to insist upon the release of Americans detained unjustly.